White Rocket Entertainment.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Episode 001, from Graviton through Ultron to Nefaria.
It's the Avengers Assemble podcast from the Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net. Now, here's your host, Van Allen Plexico.
Hello, and welcome to the premiere episode of the Avengers Assemble podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment and the Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net in association with the Earth Station One Network. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and we're kicking things off tonight in the beginning of this show with a look at the Avengers comics that started it all for me, Avengers 158 through 166. And joining us to talk about these seminal, great, great issues is David Wright, longtime friend of the show and Jarvis Head. Welcome aboard the brand new Avengers Assemble podcast, David.
Thank you very much. I am thrilled that this podcast exists. I look forward to everything it can bring us in the future, and I hope I don't ruin this too much so you'll invite me back again soon.
Well, you were the second ever guest on the White Rocket Show, which is our sister show that's been around for a while now.
Yes, that's right. I remember well. We talked about Dark Tower.
That's right.
If there's anything in pop culture that I can... That I can go on about with enthusiasm, it's definitely the Avengers. So for Van Allen Plexico, the founder of the AvengersAssemble.net website, to have a podcast totally dedicated to the Avengers, that's one I'm definitely going to follow. And I'll probably, for every episode I'm listening to, I'll be wishing that I was on there taking part in the conversation. So I'm looking forward to hopefully a long parade of Jarvis Heads you can get on the show, and then and I can think of a number of creators and editors that I hope you'll be able to grab too. So I'm looking forward to what's in store for the future of this show.
We have big plans, absolutely big plans, and the reason the show exists is, one, is because I and you and so many other people, good friends, are Avengers fans and have been for years. We had the website for 21 years of AvengersAssemble.net.
Wow.
But also because, and I'm going to mention it again toward the end, just so people can know, if you're listening to this show but you've never listened to the White Rocket podcast, that's the sister show. We're about to do episode 100, just as episode 1 of the Avengers Assemble podcast rolls out. So this series will be just about talking about the Avengers. The White Rocket podcast, we talk about basically everything else in pop culture. Lately we've talked about James Bond a lot. We've talked about Game of Thrones a lot. We've talked about Star Wars a lot. Over the years, we've covered quite a few things on there. So if you're interested in that show, you can search on iTunes for White Rocket podcast, or you can go to White Rocket, one word, whiterocket.podbean.com, and you can find all 99-plus episodes of that show. But this show, I wanted to do a show focused just on one topic. You know, it's harder to build an audience when you change topics every episode. That show's more of a potpourri, you know, it's a variety of topics. Whereas this show has just one ongoing topic, and we'll see what kind of a listener base we build. So here we go. We're going to talk about I got to do math right quick. 58, 59, 60, 60, 60, 60, 9 issues, 9 issues. Now, let me set the stage, David. First, you know what? First, I need to thank our benefactors, those who contributed to getting this show on the air.
Absolutely.
I thanked them in the zero episode, but I want to go ahead and thank them now as we actually get underway with the big time show. We did several levels at Korvac level, the big donors, the big heavy hitters, Bobby Polite and George Gaston. The Ultron level, Vince Alvarez, Bobby and Vince, both founding members of AvengersAssemble.net. At the Kang level, Michael Bailey, the longtime great host of Views from the Long Box and dear friend. and Joe Crow, longtime host over at Revolution SF and their podcast, and a Jarvis Head. And then at the Zemo level, who contributed, Earl Ricks, Dave Powell, and Bob Mendenhall. So you guys all went above and beyond the call of duty, and I really appreciate very much you doing that and getting us on the air. Now, I'm going to tell what these books mean to me and why I'm very excited to start with them in particular. And then, Dave, I want you to tell me kind of what they mean to you.
All right.
For me, this was the beginning. The first Avengers anything, the first Avengers I ever saw or heard of, other than maybe the Marvel lunchbox. Remember the Marvel lunchbox? It had about a dozen characters on it on all sides.
Yes, sir. Very okay. Well.
Yeah. I saw the characters on there. Some of the kids, I had like emergency or something stupid, but these kids came to school with the Marvel superhero lunchbox and had great art on it. And I was just staring at those lunchboxes and going, who are those guys? I mean, I kind of knew who Spider-Man was, but that was about the only one I recognized. And I stared at Iron Man and I thought, is he a statue? Is he made out of solid metal? Is he flying? Whoa, the heaviest one can actually fly? That doesn't make any sense. I was fascinated. This was in like third grade, okay? Second, third grade. So about that time, somebody bought for me, I want to say one of my parents or grandparents for some reason, I had been reading like Richie Rich comics, you know, Archie comics.
Right.
Maybe a Justice League and a Superman, but nothing Marvel. And somebody bought me Avengers 162, The Bride of Ultron. And it blew my mind, okay?
One of those key moments in life.
Oh, absolutely. And so I had to know what was going on. And would you believe I didn't – you know, that's the second half of a – well, it's really the third part of a three-part story that starts with 160, the trial that we're going to talk about in a minute. I was able to find 158, 159, and 160 pretty quickly. I think 158 and 159 were in those three comics in a plastic bag you used to could get, you know?
Yeah.
You'd get like Star Wars on one side, the Avengers on the other, and there'd be something lame in the middle that you couldn't see.
Right.
I got 158, 159, 160. I think I traded to somebody at school to get 160, and I thought I made the biggest deal in history, you know. Swindled them out of the greatest thing to give them some Richie Rich comic. But I didn't get to read 161 until I was in college. So I went a long time.
Without knowing how they ended up knocked out, huh?
Right. No, yeah. That's the thing is, starting 162, I mean, we're going to talk all about it in a minute, but just, you know, think about it from the very beginning. The first Avengers comic I'm ever reading, the first Marvel comic I'm ever reading, they're wheeling out the dead bodies of Captain America, the Beast, and the Scarlet Witch. And they're talking about, oh, I'm going to miss Cap so much, you know. And I'm like, what? And then I didn't even know who they were, you know. So these really, I mean, these were the first seeds planted in my mind that grew into everything, you know, that came after that. So what do these issues mean to you? Because I think that you came in a little bit later, right? So you kind of had to go back to these. So it's going to be a slightly different story.
Yeah, definitely. I'm, you know, 2 or 3 years younger than you. And I think I was also 2 or 3 years further along in life before I started reading comics. So I came on, 211 was my very first issue. And that, I've talked about that before on the White Rocket show. It was that made an equally huge impression on me because that was an Old Order Changeth issue where and I saw a bunch of these, you know, Avengers at the beginning and they all left and a new team came in by the end of the issue and I felt like I was getting in on a good starting point and it really helped me like hook into the series very quickly. So these issues exist for me as back issues. I had read the second Jim Shooter run, which started with 211. That was his first issue back on the series. I had read the first Jim Shooter run. I had read the second Jim Shooter run before I ever read these on his original run. So in issue 158 is his very first issue writing the Avengers. So this was a case of I was starting at 211. I felt like I was starting in the middle of the story. So while I was buying the new issues as they came out, hungrily, you know, eating up the new issues, I felt like there's 200 issues of history that I need to learn and I want to know about. And so it became a journey of discovery of searching for back issues everywhere and learning more about the team. Okay, that's what that reference is talking about. that's why they have a problem with Ultron. So it was it just kept providing depth and context to my understanding of the team as I found these back issues. And what was, of course, amazing, and I'm sure this, I mean, 1977 is probably the single greatest year of Avengers comics, you would probably say, in human history.
Yeah. But, oh, absolutely. 1977 is my favorite year, as Peter O'Toole would say.
Well, these these issues we're going to talk about tonight and what's going to come after that, you know, between Bride of Ultron, Nefaria, and then the Korvac Saga. I mean, just bam, bam, bam. Just one after another with some of the, you know, with mostly George Perez on art. You got, you know, it was just... It was quality. It was quality. You could just tell there was quality there, and I was thoroughly entertained by it. But I was coming at them as, you know, I experienced them as back issues. The series was probably in the 230s or something, early on in the Roger Stern run before I found these issues.
Yeah. You know, I guess the first shooter run for you is kind of like Englehart was for me, because in the early issues that I was reading in the 160s, they were constantly referring back to Kang and the stuff in the Old West and all that, and I'm going, what? And so it was exciting for me, you know, a few years later. We didn't have a comic shop in my little town in Alabama,
right?
And so it was quite a while before I got a chance to start getting back issues, and that was the only way. There was no online or anything, as you well know.
Right.
So it was quite a while before I got to go back and read, you know, anything with Kang. I don't think I see that was always, you know, it's funny. I always like to say that Kang is supposed to be like the Avengers, probably, you know, first or second greatest villain, and yet I came in right after he had been supposedly killed for good in Englehart's run. And they didn't really use him again as Kang until what, Roger Stern, way later.
Right. And you weren't reading the series at the time.
No.
Missed Stern. Okay.
Yeah, I missed Stern completely. I was out. It was probably, gosh, the first contemporary comics that actually had Kang in them that I read were probably Avengers Forever.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Well, that's a masterpiece. That's a whole other episode just by itself.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of that, now I need to mention this. Yeah, we will do things like Avengers Forever, but you made me think of this just now, that it's all well and good that we're covering this run of Avengers, but it is 1977, and the greatest Avengers story possibly of that year was not in these issues. It was in Avengers Annual Number 7 and Marvel 2-in-1 Annual Number 2.
Yep.
And I'm thinking a whole show just on that.
You know what? I think you need multiple guests for that show.
And we need to go all the way back to Warlock and Captain Marvel and talk about all the stuff that led into Starlin kind of blowing it out.
Yeah, you know, I had read those pair of annuals probably 10 years ago now, and I think you pointed me to them, and it was definitely awesome. But I had not able to fully appreciate it until I recently read the Avengers versus Thanos trade paperback collection, which did collect all those stories you're talking about, the older Captain Marvel and Warlock stories.
Yeah.
And to realize what Starlin was really building on from his previous work. I had really missed all that.
It's amazing, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I wonder about what they're going to do in the Marvel Cinematic Universe with Warlock, because on the one hand, I just can't imagine a great Avengers epic against Thanos in the movies that doesn't involve Warlock. But on the other hand, I equally cannot imagine how you do Warlock in a movie.
Yeah, or how do you introduce someone so key so late in the storytelling structure, you know?
I've said on other shows, and maybe with you, I can't remember, I almost think it's got to be Doctor Strange in that role.
Hmm.
And they're bringing him in, and he can do a lot of the stuff Warlock can do.
Ed, do you think that, like, Star-Lord's father could be... fill that kind of role somehow? Some kind of cosmic...
Yeah, I don't know. The further we get away from Guardians of the Galaxy, the less I think Star-Lord's father is going to matter that much. I was excited about it at the time, but I'm starting to, you know. Oh, well. We'll speculate about the MCU in later. Believe me, audience listeners, we are going to talk a great deal about the Marvel movies. This show is not just about comics. It's about everything. We're going to talk about the animated series. We're going to talk about the movies, you know, everything that's been on TV, everything in the comics, and then novels, too. We'll do a show on the Marvel novels over the years. So But now let's go ahead and dig into tonight's main topic, Avengers 158 through 166, and kind of look at what was going on in those issues, what made them so great, what we liked about them, what questions we might have had about them. You start off, now we have to set the stage for 158 by saying that this was a transitional period in the Avengers series. Why don't you kind of lay out for us your understanding, David, of what was going on that made it a transition point?
Well, they're just I didn't research this part of it. I didn't refresh my memory here. But after Englehart left, there was really kind of a lot of instability at the writer's standpoint. And I know like 150, which is supposed to be this significant milestone issue, was a bit of a mess, kind of a disaster. In fact, they had to fill it with a reprint and then try to continue the story in issue 151. And it was kind of by committee, and there was a bunch of different hands in there. And it was kind of aimless there for a while, which is really for the first time in the series history. And here we were, you know, from 63 with Stan Lee all the way through the end of Steve Englehart. You'd only had three writers in the entire history.
It's amazing.
It had been something like 15 years or maybe 13 years. And it had been extremely stable from a writing perspective. And this was really the first, like, turbulent time, and we're kind of an aimless period where there wasn't a lot of stability at the writer position. And then Jerry Conway, who I believe might have been editing the entire line, he took about 6 months on the job, I think. I don't know. But he took his turn writing the Avengers, and he kind of settled in. He kind of became the writer there for – he was the closest thing to a regular writer during this little period between the late 140s and leading into the Jim Shooter era. So Jerry Conway's last issue – as a writer for the Avengers was 157. And really it was with this issue in 158 with the new name in the writer credit, Jim Shooter. So, that, you know, maybe I don't know if you could tell it at the time. I don't know if, you know, but it certainly, as we look back on it from, with this perspective, this was the beginning of, not only a stable period, but a very exciting period and one of the highlights of the entire series.
Yeah, no, you did that better than I could have. That was great. Shooter was an interesting guy. He was very young. He had actually started writing Legion of Superheroes for DC, I believe, when he was a teenager. And he would write them on a legal pad and, like, mail in the legal pad pages to DC. And he ended up working at Marvel. And of course, down the road, things get very bumpy and he kind of alienates a lot of people. But right now, when he's just writing the Avengers and a couple other books for Marvel, I think was really the high point of his career, at least to me. And so, yeah, this is a transitional issue. At the end of 157.
Can I take this? Because,
you know,
Black Knight is my...
That's true. Yes. Tell us about Black Knight and what's going on.
Black Knight's my character.
I'm sorry.
He's my favorite Avenger, and the 157 ended with his apparent death because his he was like bound to the statue, and the statue was destroyed and left in crumbles, and that was the end of the issue. As it turns out, we don't find out in this run of issues, but you know, in other books, we find out that his spirit actually transported to the 12th century. He was fighting in the Crusades. It is. And I think the last time we talked about Avengers on the other show, I mentioned how issue 225 was my first issue, or maybe I said this online, my first issue receiving in the mail and from a mail subscription. So I was very excited to get issue 225, and it was the one that had big Black Knight on the cover. Well, that was the issue where he returned, where he was saved from this broken statue status quo, and of course, I had read that first. I discovered 158 as a back issue, and here I was learning the backstory. Okay, oh, that cool issue with Black Knight. Here's how here's what happened just before that. So
yeah, this,
but what I'm getting, I guess I went off track. But 157, Conway's last issue ends with the statue in shambles, in pieces.
So it was like a statue of the Black Knight that was animated by his spirit through time or something, and attacked
him like that. Yeah. And when the story ended, it was once again a dormant statue, but then it was destroyed.
Right, and the Vision, I think, destroyed it. Right,
I started my reread for this show with 158.
Yeah,
I think Greg Gargoyle may have been involved somewhere.
Maybe so. I don't know, but in any case,
what I was going to get to is the most seamless transition in writers that you can have, because Shooter starts his splash page off with the crumbs of the Black Knight statue in the foreground, and it picks right up. It picks immediately up in this, almost in the same scene as the end of Conway's last scene. So unless you're paying attention to the names in the corner, you're not even going to notice. It's a very smooth transition out of the Conway / Chaos era.
Yeah,
a little mini era there of kind of messed up issues, and then Shooter just picks right back. He picks the ball up right where he found it, and not, doesn't try to come in and wipe the slate clean. Just start where he wants to. He really respected what immediately came before him, and it really made for an extremely seamless transition.
And we don't know exactly where Conway was probably going with that, but what was interesting was that Shooter clearly has completely different ideas of what to do with these characters. And so 158 starts out, it's really two completely separate stories in this issue that kind of dovetail together at the end. But it starts out, you know, everybody else is kind of waking up, the Vision standing over the destroyed body of the Black Knight, and everybody else is kind of getting up, and Wonder Man is kind of supporting Wanda, helping her after she's been knocked out, and the Vision kind of loses his mind and attacks Wonder Man, like in a fit of jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
So you get this battle. In fact, the name of the issue is When Avengers Clash. And you get this battle through half of Avengers Mansion where Wonder Man and the Vision are smashing each other and disrupting each other and all that. And what we're seeing is that Jim Shooter was fascinated with the idea that the Vision had Wonder Man's brain patterns, right?
Definitely. Now, you know, I'd have to go back and read Conway's issues. Conway may have introduced this idea of, hey, you know, Wanda might be if she's attracted to Vision, she might be attracted to Simon.
Exactly.
That might have really, the seed of that might have started with Conway, but definitely, you know, it comes to the forefront here, and Shooter, you know, spins some drama out of it. The fight's fun to look at. I should point out that this issue is Sal Buscema and mm-hmm. and Pablo Marcos.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just good, you know, solid old school Marvel action. This was, you know, I had never considered the idea that, hey, you know, Wanda and Simon might have something. And again, I get maybe it was much later when I found these issues, because the first time I even like saw a writer play with that was like John Byrne on West Coast Avengers.
Oh, right.
And so I quickly, you know, figured out he was not the one that first came up with that. But it makes sense. You know, why didn't somebody do that before now? I don't know.
Well, and clearly Shooter is very fascinated with it. He brings it up a couple of times. But the thing is, after this issue, they never really mention it again. I mean, it's like they make up, and it's weird too. There's an inconsistency that runs through the character here, and it may have been a hangover from wherever what Conway had been doing with him. But as you read through 158 and then on into 159, 160, 161, what you see, the Vision had this huge emotional reaction and was about ready to kill Wonder Man, but within a couple of issues, everybody's fine. And also in 158, the Vision basically acts like he's about to break up with Wanda, divorce her or something, because he's got this whole self-pity thing of, I'm just a machine, you know, you should have never married me to begin with, oh, I'm just not worthy, I'm just some machine. And then within a couple of issues, he's gotten over that, and everything is fine, and he and Wanda are just fine, and Wonder Man's, you know, nobody's punching anybody. So it's just an interesting thing how Shooter raises this question, and the relationship thing within it, the jealousy thing, never goes anywhere. But what he does get out of it in 160 is the setup for the trial with the Grim Reaper.
Yeah, that's no doubt. And I think, as you see, he hits the ground running with his first scene in his Avengers run. He's already drawing stories out of the kind of family connections, the family tree that runs through the Avengers. So
yeah,
and that manifests itself whether with a jealousy fight with Vision and Simon, or and then culminating again with the trial that brings in the Grim Reaper. So you just get more and more, you know. It's the one of the appeals of the Avengers series that fans have is that family tree.
Yes, just what I was going to say.
And to see how they all interconnect. And really, it's stories just like this one where we get that sense, where, you know, that informs our impression of the Avengers, that makes us say that it's happening right here in this issue.
Yeah, the Avengers, I've always said, are not like the X-Men where they're one big family. The Avengers are like three or four different families that all cohabitate. And just like any bunches of roommates, they don't get along always from time to time. You know, there's clashes. And so, you know, I've always said there's like the Pym wing of the mansion that's got Yellow Jacket or Ant-Man, whatever you want to call Pym, the Wasp. And then, of course, Ultron is over there, and the Vision is kind of there because he was created by Ultron. So you got that wing of the family.
Right.
You've got the mutant wing where Quicksilver, Wanda, the Beast, and all them kind of are. But then Wanda married the Vision, so that kind of connects those two together. So they're kind of a family, you know. And then you've got sort of the Thor, Captain America, Iron Man, the big three part over there where they kind of think that they know the best and can run everything until everybody else would do. And I'm sure I'm forgetting other branches, but yeah, I totally agree. It's the soap opera internal conflicts among these characters that are what make it so fascinating. Otherwise, it would just be generic, you know, strong guys pounding away at strong villains, and it would be boring.
Absolutely, you're exactly right. And for a casual reader or someone who doesn't follow comics and just kind of glances at some pages, all they see is a bunch of color and people clashing and punching each other. But if you read it, you start to learn these characters, start to discover the characters. It's the connections between them and the relationships between them. You know, for example, the appeal of Wonder Man is not his power set. I mean, you know, he can punch. He's strong. Okay, got it. Mm-hmm. It's his connections to the rest of the team. You know, as an example. So definitely, it's the it's that interpersonal drama, I guess you could say, that draws readers in and rewards readers, yeah, you know, to stick around for a significant amount of time, multiple issues.
So the rest of 158 is like I said, these are really like two half issues glued together, because once the big tantrum is over between Vision and Wonder Man, they get a message and we get the origin or the sort of a we pick up in transition as Graviton is becoming a thing. Now, Graviton is an interesting character because on the one hand, he's right in the same class with Magneto in terms of powers.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of the fundamental forces of the universe. You think he'd be a heavy in the Marvel universe.
But
no pun intended.
Right. Very good. Very well played. But on the other hand, it shows you what happens when enormous power like a Magneto has goes to an idiot.
Yeah, exactly.
He doesn't know what to – he's just like a stock thug that doesn't really know what to do with his power that he gets.
Got no ambition and no vision.
Other than just to be like king of the world or something.
Yeah. He's there's no reason why he shouldn't be on the same level with Magneto. He just doesn't seem to think that big, I guess.
No. Now, it is interesting that his great original evil scheme shows up in a movie.
Yeah, I don't know if I think you might be getting ahead by one issue if you're just going to throw these in, but in 159 is where we really see that.
The floating city. Well, no, he goes ahead and rips it up, I believe.
Does he?
Maybe. Yeah, I don't know. It's along the way during this story, so.
Yeah, the whole city goes up in the air.
We can just roll right on into 159 because now we're into the Graviton story. So we'll just go ahead and go into 158, 159. At the end of 158, the Avengers attack Graviton on his Sky Island or wherever it is, and he takes him down pretty easy.
Yeah.
Now there's no Thor.
There's no Thor, but he just throws Vision up into the ceiling and I guess turns Cap's shield into, like, you know, something that weighs thousands of pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And he pretty much. He dispenses the whole team in like three pages.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And this is a run where the Avengers just keep fighting these villains that are just way more powerful than them. This is one of the things that I absolutely love about Jim Shooter, the way he writes the Avengers during this period, is he always provides them with an enemy that is not only more powerful than any one of them, that is often more powerful than all of them put together.
Yeah.
That was what I loved. And I mean, not to put in a plug here, but when I write my superhero novels, the Sentinels books, as I guess most of you listening probably know, when I write those books, that's one of the things I've always tried to emulate, even subconsciously, is the idea that the villains need to not just be on a par with the heroes, they need to be above the heroes, and they need to be above all the heroes put together. I love that idea. I mean, the other series that's really was really good at that back then was the X-Men. Mm-hmm. The difference was when the X-Men would fight a foe like that, the way that Claremont would write it, you'd feel like they're all going to die. You know, I used to read the X-Men under Claremont back in the 70s, and I was thinking, well, they're all, I mean, Magneto's going to kill them all, or whoever they're fighting, the Hellfire Club's going to kill them all. Whereas with the Avengers, you always had the sense they could all be killed, but they're, you know, so big and iconic and heroic that they're going to find a way, but it's going to be interesting to see how they do it because good grief, you know?
Right. I mean, you look at this run we're talking about tonight, just grab, I mean, Graviton, what are we, Graviton, Ultron, and Nefaria. I mean, boom, 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 just power. I mean, how many times do we see the entire roster, like, laid out unconscious in a single panel? You know, it happens multiple times. It seems like once with each of these bad guys. So
absolutely.
Definitely the power level of the villains in this run of issues, you know, like a 1-2-3 punch is definitely impressive.
Now let me talk about Thor for a minute here, because he's going to figure into this whole little run all the way up until we get into the next time we talk about 167 through 177.
Yeah, and he's absent in 158. Yeah.
He's absent in 158, and the villain is like, oh, I wish Thor was here. I really want to test my might against him. And then what's funny is the same exact thing happens in 165 when Super Count Nefaria is beating the Avengers and says, oh, I wish Thor was here. I want to test my might against him. And both times they get their wish.
Yes. And turns out there's a reason for that, but I guess that's another show.
Yeah, that gets us into what the Collector is doing. So we'll talk about that when we get into the Korvac saga. But it's so cool that Shooter was already manipulating things to set up his big magnum opus that would come up starting in 167. There was a slow burn along the lines of the Kree-Skrull War.
Absolutely. And I'd have to go back and read Thomas and Englehart again to see if any of them really you know, planted seeds for future stories as early as Shooter did. It's like Shooter came in with a 5-year plan on day one, and he was already weaving in stuff that was going to pay off a couple years later. And he might not have been the very first Avenger writer to do that, but he certainly did it very well.
Yeah. So 159 is basically, I think we can zip through this one pretty quickly. It's basically just Graviton lording it over the defeated Avengers. And the Sky Island flies over New York. But what's significant here, there is a great scene with Jarvis in the mansion, and I love it. I love the thought that we can check in on the butler, and he's watching it on TV and wishing he could do something, and he actually does go and help.
Yes.
I love that. I mean, Shooter always try to give Jarvis a role, and everybody loved that. So Thor and the Black Panther show up, and they go to try to help.
Well, there's a great shot in here, and this is Sal Buscema, mm-hmm. Where Graviton's using his gravity powers to, like, keep all the Avengers imprisoned vertically against this wall. It's like they're pinned to a, mm-hmm. like they're butterfly, or like a butterfly collection pinned to a wall, and that is like, you look at that. I looked at that, and I was like, you know, how can the Avengers possibly win? He can so casually just, like, keep them pressed up against the wall like this, but. I don't know. It's just a visual that I remember from that issue that stands out. And it's right when Thor shows up.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And then what ultimately beats Graviton is not so much the Avengers as Graviton loses control. His girl, the woman he likes, who of course doesn't like him. There's an evil girl that likes him, but he likes the good girl. And she jumps off the side of the Sky Island, and Jarvis catches her, we find out at the end. Yay, Jarvis.
On a sky sled,
yeah. So Graviton loses control of his powers. The Sky Island crumbles into the size of like the big globe outside of Universal Studios.
Right.
And drops, and you get to – that's when I was a kid, I learned who the strong Avengers were, because the Vision, Wonder Man, Thor, and Iron Man are the four that catch it.
Yes.
And throw it into the bay or whatever, the New York Harbor. So, so everything ends well, and you think, yay, no more, no, you know, it's all, we can all relax. But then 160 comes along, and this one is interesting because now we get George Perez, I believe, right?
Yes, this is George Perez's first issue.
Oh, glorious, glorious. And
I mean, I like Selby Sima to an extent, but, you know, George Perez, I mean, these are the issues that he forged his reputation on.
Right. And the neat thing is, Shooter was always so good, Jim Shooter, at moving the pieces on the board around just the way he needed to make the story work. So 160, the trial begins with Thor, Cap, Iron Man, Scarlet, the Yellow Jacket and the Wasp, and the Wizard all leaving, and we see them leaving, which just leaves behind the Vision and Wonder Man, Scarlet Witch, the Beast, and the Black Panther. Not their most powerful lineup, though not a bad lineup by any means.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to kind of move things along, they get attacked by the Grim Reaper, who is the brother, Eric Williams, the brother of Simon Williams, Wonder Man. And he just kind of is trying to figure... He's a longtime villain. He had something to do with the Vision being created. He worked for Ultron. And he wants to know which is his real brother. Is the Vision more his brother now because he's got Wonder Man's brain patterns? And is Wonder Man really his brother because he was dead and has come back, you know, and how real is he? And, of course, we find out a little bit later, Simon Williams is not really, you know...
Yeah.
I mean, he is an energy being, basically, now.
Yeah, well, you know, his resurrection was kind of odd, and I don't know if it was handled very, very elegantly, but he originally came back as basically a zombie.
Yeah.
And then it turns out the zombie just kind of woke up and he wasn't really a zombie anymore. So it was kind of, that was a question about exactly how do we get this character back that I don't think had really been fully examined. So it was probably good for the reader to, you know, to have this trial just so we could figure out exactly who this Simon Williams guy was at this point. So.
Oh, yeah. This was a really useful issue. Both in terms of it's got cool characters. The Grim Reaper looks cool in his new darker costume. Gets rid of that horrible green and yellow, red thing, whatever. But also, and you get some good battles with his scythe and everything. But like you said, you get some great flashbacks that explain who Wonder Man is. And we begin to realize that Shooter is fascinated by Wonder Man. He's not even a member of the Avengers yet, and yet he's arguably the most interesting character and probably in story terms the most important character in these three issues.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
He's not even an Avenger.
Yep.
In fact, at one point he says something like, Captain America just was telling me stuff to do as if I were an Avenger. Wow, he must think I'm good enough to be an Avenger. He's had a lot of confidence issues, you know.
Yeah, and that comes to the fore, you know, later too during I think the Korvac saga, but definitely this is if you had not read any of the previous 150 something issues, this told you a lot about these three characters: Vision, Simon, and Grim Reaper. You know, you get the Vision origin about being made from the Human Torch body and stuff like that. So
yeah.
And it's also gorgeous with George drawing it too. So
absolutely. So rolling on along, 161.
Let me say real quick. It was in 160 that we get the dramatic reveal of Simon Williams' eyeballs.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
So
he doesn't have them.
He doesn't have any. It's just it's like, can you imagine how creepy that is? So you're going to just look into these ocular cavities and you just see like roiling ionic energy just boiling inside this guy you thought was a regular human being. So I guess this was Shooter's idea that not only was he resurrected, but going back to his origin in issue 9 when Zemo bombarded him with ionic rays or ionic energy, that he's resurrected, but he's really just...
transformed like a cocoon. He's just come out.
Energy being.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, I think that's a pretty dramatic moment and certainly a significant moment for Simon's, you know, character history. Happens right here in 160. So it kind of changes how we look at him from now on.
And I loved his costume in 158 through 160. And I love his costume in 161, 162. This is the last time we see him in that costume, though. First he had the green and red costume, and then he had the green, yellow, and red costume with kind of a WM pattern on his chest. He had like a helmet with those goggles and everything. I just thought, and he's just muscular. I just thought he didn't look like any other character. And I mean, it's not the most. It was never a costume that looked great in terms of like aesthetics, But I just thought it worked for him. He had those giant wristbands, you know, that just made his fist look huge, and that's what he's all about, you know.
Right.
And he looked like a construction worker with these giant fists and his helmet. I loved that, and it kept getting destroyed because he's much stronger than his costume.
Yeah.
So finally, he ends up in the red safari jacket, which is sort of what everybody thinks of, I think, when they think of is an odd choice, but that's what they put him in after all this.
And for some reason, it stuck, you know, for a long time. So.
Mm-hmm, long time, yeah. I never liked that look. I wanted him to go back to his yellow, red, and green suit with the helmet and all. I just thought that was cool. So anyway, one thing I got to say about Avengers 161 cover is we get the one of George Perez's most infamous art boo-boos.
Oh, yeah?
Everybody's covered in ants on the cover. It's attacked by the Ant-Man. But the ants all have eight legs. Because George didn't realize ants have six legs and spiders have eight legs. So they're actually, I guess, some kind of mutant ants that are working for him.
Have you ever given him a hard time for that?
No. I remember it coming up in the letters page around 165, 166, somewhere in there. So he was getting grief about it back in the 70s. He doesn't need me to talk about it. But yeah, so you're reading it and you're wondering, wait a minute, what in the world's going on? Ant-Man's a good guy. Why does he not recognize any of the Avengers? You know, something's going on. And now we get into another one of Shooter's favorite things to do stories about, which is Henry Pym having mental issues.
Yeah, I think up until this point, first of all, this is what, 1977. Had Scott Lang been created yet?
I don't think so. No, not we hadn't got that Marvel premiere or spotlight or whatever it was yet. Okay. I don't believe so.
All right, so this is the first time we'd seen Pym as Ant-Man in a long time.
Yeah,
but you know, there's certainly the question of his sanity or his mental stability was, you know, that was part of the story back when he was getting married, issue 60 or whatever it was, to Jan as Yellowjacket. But I don't know if. This may be the first time that's picked back up since then.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think clearly we can say, since this is very early in Shooter's first run, and we know what he did with Pym in his second run when he came back.
Oh, boy.
To the,
we'll get to that.
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's safe to say that he had planned – this was his idea for Pym coming onto the book, you know, what am I going to do with each of these characters?
Yeah.
He looked back at that wedding and how kind of he was kind of crazy at the time and didn't really know who he was. And he decided to go with that. And this may be the first time since around issue 60 of the wedding that we see Pym as not entirely stable.
Yeah, he's going to take Pym off in directions that he's never recovered from.
Exactly.
He's never recovered from. So there's a big battle, and Ant-Man Pym does about as well as could be expected going up against a whole bunch of Avengers. He uses surprise mainly, but ultimately he is knocked out, and Jan shows up in her most revealing costume. Imagine George wanting to draw that. And we find out she's wearing it because he seemed very distracted and whatever, and she's been trying to get his attention, so she's wearing this revealing costume. And basically she takes him back to their lab to try to help him, and their Ultron abducts her. Actually, no, she goes back. Right, I'm trying to think. Yeah, the Beast drops her off, and she goes back, and that's where Ultron gets her. The Avengers have Pym. There's a little interlude there where Hawkeye and Two Gun Kid are living on a dude ranch. I never did understand. That's left over from the Englehart period, and
yes, it is.
There's this bit where the phone's ringing and Two Gun Kid shoots it because he doesn't know what it is and it's making noise.
Right, and that's I guess basically how you keep Hawkeye out of the story.
Yeah,
because Two Gun shot his phone.
Yeah. So this is where Ultron finally – this is going to roll us on into 162 because this is all one big story.
Yeah.
Ultron attacks the mansion to abduct Pym because he needs him for his evil plan. And this is where the Avengers fighting Ultron, the Adamantium Ultron, the Battleship Gray Ultron, the scary Ultron, the cussing robot Ultron that I love so much, he zaps them. And the ones he doesn't apparently kill, he certainly incapacitates. So when Ultron's blitzkrieg through the mansion is done, Scarlet Witch is apparently dead. Captain America apparently dead. The Beast apparently dead. The Iron Man has been drained and is lying there stuck in his armor, you know, as if he just punched the Hulk and run out of energy. Ant-Man has been captured. And even the Vision, I think the Vision was appears dead. And Wonder Man's been kind of knocked out. And I think the Black Panther, I remember he was dead or...
They're all in that final panel. Yeah,
just lying there on his name. God save us, says Jarvis. Yes.
Yeah.
So that rolls us into the famous The Bride of Ultron. So we can kind of comment on these two together.
Now, this is not Ultron's first appearance, of course.
No.
But it's George Perez. And certainly, I mean, it's one of the best Ultron stories.
I think if
this had been the first issue you had ever seen and read, it would have had as equal an impression on you because you talk about just a scary villain just steamrolling over the team. A lot of fun.
My first issue, the all-time best.
All the
ones we looked at so far, I had to go back and get later. But this is my first ever Avengers issue, 162, cover dated August 1977. And that cover, how could you not want this comic book when you see that cover? It's Ultron standing in the middle of the cover, and everybody's attacking him at once, and he's just casually blasting them all away. The Avengers at war with the most indestructible, unstoppable menace of all. Showdown with Ultron. And it's called The Bride of Ultron, which is a great name. It's just like, I guess, to some degree, The Bride of Frankenstein. It's a takeoff on Oedipus, right?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's the Oedipus complex is what defines Ultron for sure.
He wants to kill his father and marry his mother.
Yeah, and by creating his own bride and basing it on Jan, it takes that Oedipus thing, to the next level.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, we have Jim Shooter to thank for that.
So Thor arrives again, having been off doing whatever, which we know now the collector's zapping him around to keep him from getting killed or whatever. Meanwhile, and you see the Avengers that aren't apparently, I keep saying apparently dead because you later find out that Ultron put them in comas and they get revived. But for the rest of this issue, they're apparently dead. And the Avengers think that they're basically going into getting ready for a second round with a villain that just killed half the team, including Captain America. and the Vision, more or less. So, now we see Ultron. He's totally bamboozled Henry Pym into thinking that Ultron's the good guy, the Avengers are intruders, Jan has been injured, and the only way to save her is to transfer her life force into the metal body of his bride, who we will later know as Jocasta.
Of course.
Who comes a really cool Avenger later. But so Pym is just enough in his right mind to know something's going on, but he just keeps trying to – but he's so worried about Jan that he keeps – he keeps at it.
Yeah, he thinks that's what he has to do to save her. And something about, I think, you know, he doesn't remember anything since he quit being Ant-Man. So he doesn't know who all these strange people are calling themselves Avengers. And Ultron's just able to manipulate him, I guess, and get him to make this transference. Not a bright day, not a proud day for Henry Pym.
No, and it's really, I mean, I think this is the thing that pushes him over the edge of starting to go back to being unstable again. And after he had been doing so well for a while, it's really unfortunate. But like I said, I mean, Shooter had a handful of characters he just was determined to put through the ringer. And one of them was Wonder Man, and one of the others was Henry Pym. Mm-hmm. So the Avengers are trying to find where Ultron has taken the two of them. And they never can figure it out. But then a bunch of ants on the floor spell out Starkli, Stark Long Island.
Yeah, they literally spell it out for them.
Yes, as ants, right. And we later find out it wasn't Pym that sent them, and it wasn't Jan that sent them. It was probably Jocasta that did it.
Yes.
She had become just sentient and conscious enough that she was trying to get help, too. So the Avengers do one of their patented super frontal assaults on Ultron, where everybody's smashing in the walls and coming through the ceiling. It took me a long time to figure out what angle I was supposed to see that panel where Thor throws his hammer through. I couldn't figure out if he was coming up through the floor or coming through the wall or coming down through the ceiling. It's kind of a strange angle.
I know what you're talking about. It's weird. That's Perez. He knew master of the perspective.
Yeah, he likes different interesting views and perspectives, but sometimes it gets a little confusing. So
I can't stress enough just how awesome George Perez's work is on these issues.
Well,
I just, you know, it's like Salvi Sim is solid, he's good, but then you get George, it's a whole new
world. Right. It doesn't take anything away from Sal. Sal's fantastic. I love 158, 159, but George is just the man. I mean, we talked to Kurt Busiek one time years ago at Dragon Con about how, you know, he wrote a panel as the Avengers walk through this lab. And when you get the comic, it's like is it a one or a two-page spread of a spiral round and round and round?
Two-page spread. It's the first issue of their Ultron story that they did.
Yeah. And the Avengers are just like small on this thing that's just all this stuff, you know, around them. So he just kind of did his own thing with it.
Yeah, and just multiple layers going down. It's like, you know, and all Kurt said was they walk into a lab. So, I mean,
yeah.
it's got to be a joy to work with George if you're a comic writer.
Oh, yeah. So the Avengers do a frontal assault on Ultron. It goes about as poorly as you would imagine. He taunts them with the fact that he's animanium and so forth.
He punches Thor and Wonder Man at the same time. He just casually just...
Why not? He's basically a nuclear explosion inside an indestructible body. I mean, so he can do whatever he wants. And so anyway, Iron Man figures out a clever strategy, which is that he grabs Jocasta as it's cool. I love that Thor. I mean, we emulated this in the Sentinels where I had Shiva, I believe, grab Vanguard, the big robot, by his trident around his neck like that. Thor's got his hammer holding Ultron's head back while Wonder Man is kind of like attacking him from the front. And they're like, and Thor says, "Excellent, though we cannot harm him. The two of us have strength enough to hold him thus." And Wonder Man says, "Yeah, right." But then Iron Man's like, "Yo-ho, over here."
Uh-huh.
And we see
Tony Stark in one of his most ruthless moments. He's got a repulsor weapon aimed right at her head.
Yep. He's like, let everybody go or she's going to get it. And so Ultron has all been out of shape, and he agrees. He lets them go, and he flies away. And I like whenever Ultron takes off, he's just like an unguided missile. He's like a bottle rocket without a stick. You know, he just, boom, takes off and gone. And so...
Can I read this panel?
Yeah.
So Ultron leaves, and they've won for now. And Black Panther says... But there is little honor in a victory that is won by, and Tony says, "Stow it, Panther. Like you said, it worked." And then he thinks to himself, "But what if it hadn't? Would you have killed her?" And it's like, dang, Tony. All right. A little foreshadowing of Tony the villain.
Yeah. He's pragmatic. I mean, there's
pragmatic.
The Panther has got to be the most honorable character in the room at all times. You know, he is a prince or a king, depending on when you're talking about. Whereas Tony has just got to do what's going to do what works, and he's not going to worry about those sorts of things at that time. So,
yeah, and I'm kind of teasing on purpose, but still, that does seem kind of ruthless. I don't know if we saw that from Iron Man before, at least not in the Avengers book. I don't know about a solo book.
Right. And it shows again that Shooter wants to get into the heads of these characters and show how they're different and show how they play off against each other. And it's really,
well, you do get that. You do start to get distinct personalities. You know, he does give each character their own their own voice, so to speak. So you definitely, you know, there's definitely shadings, you know, between characters where you can really, you know, distinguish them by their personalities and the way they speak. So yeah, credit there for sure.
So any other thoughts about the big Ultron Grim Reaper trilogy before we move on into our fill-in issue and then our last little stop?
Okay. Yeah, just the fact that this is one of the best stories in the history of the series. I mean, you're playing with that family tree of characters, and I think you advance the Ultron story by introducing the concept of Jocasta, and it's all done with George Perez. So, I mean... My goodness, if you don't like these two issues, then, you know, there's no hope for you of ever being an Avengers fan.
And not only that, but Ultron gets away at the end, and the Jocasta story is kind of left hanging, and Shooter is going to pick it back up again right in the middle of the Korvac saga.
Right
in the middle. of Korvac, you get a two-issue extravaganza where we finish this Ultron story out.
And I love that. I love that he's just weaving a continuing story with these characters. And it's not just, you know, tell this story A to Z, boom, done, go to the next one, boom, done. It feels a lot more organic and, you know, like I said, and it's rewarding for readers to follow the series. So
absolutely. It's amazing. So 163, I'm not going to say a whole lot about it. I don't know if you want to, but this was basically an inventory issue, a fill-in issue that could have been you. This could have been an Iron Man issue if they needed it. This could have been an Avengers issue, which is where they end up using it, 163. It could have been a Champions issue. It could have been an annual, probably, if it had a backup feature to make it a little bit longer. So they could have used this in any number of ways. Shooter wrote it, but George Tuska and Pablo Marcos drew it. And it's basically Iron Man forced to fight the Champions, which is one of the weirder superhero teams in Marvel history.
Yeah, it's hard. I don't think a team like that would pass today's audience because, you know, Hercules, Iceman, Ghost Rider, and Black Widow. I mean that's just so random. But yeah, definitely I get the impression this is just an inventory issue. It's probably been sitting in the shelf for a long time, and they needed to buy themselves some time with the schedule, and they threw this in. What's interesting is that Jim Shooter is the only writer listed. So I guess Shooter wrote an inventory story.
Yeah.
But he also was able to kind of shade the dialogue a little bit so that it kind of still fit in with what he was doing with the book. It wasn't like it was an inventory issue written by somebody else. I get the feeling that the artwork existed, but the script was done, you know, in line with the rest of these because he does kind of make some vague references to let you know, hey, this issue does count. It is happening contemporarily. So, but I would say the biggest thing maybe that comes out of this otherwise throwaway issue is that it ends with Beast wondering about his life, about being an Avenger. Like, what am I, you know, he starts to question his place on the team. And that, but again, that was done in the scripting stage, you know, so definitely just kind of a plug in here that kind of is a departure from everything else that he was doing with the series.
Well, there's two things I really like about this issue, besides the fact that it's certainly an above-average fill-in issue, because usually fill-in issues are pretty bad. I think this is an above-average fill-in issue, but two things I like about it. One is with Tuska's art and the way he draws Iron Man, this has the feel of an Iron Man issue from around the issues 80s or 90s. I mean, it really feels like a Bill Mantlo era Iron Man issue. The way that Tuska draws Iron Man, he really is one of the classic Iron Man artists. I mean, I know that Bob Layton kind of has gone down as the definitive, you know, Bronze Age, early post-Bronze Age. But, I mean, and Tuska's more like – Tuska's got more Colin in him, you know, more Gene Colin.
Yeah, definitely. I can definitely see that.
But yet – and sometimes I can't even tell the difference between the two. But like, you know, when you go to Hobby Lobby or wherever, you'll see those Iron Man, you know, reproduction covers and posters and metal things and all, you know, I got a couple of them and it's always Tuska art. It's very rare. Occasionally you'll get some Layton, but usually it's that old Tuska from the mid 70s, which I love. So even though he was never the greatest artist for the kind, I mean, you know, somebody like Eddie Granov or Bob Layton have a technical edge to their art.
Yeah.
The Tuskas and Colons are better suited drawing like Dracula.
Or they're Daredevil. Probably not best suited for somebody in a suit of metal,
but yet they're so tied to that character going back decades that when I see it, it still feels like Iron Man to me.
Okay.
I see this issue, and this feels like an Iron Man issue to me.
So Tuska was drawing the Mantlo issues?
He drew some of them, yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
Like the big Ultimo fight back in 96 seems like it was the same. I'm pretty sure that was also Tuska. The other thing I like about this issue is that Iron Man beats all the champions single-handedly, including Hercules. That just makes me very happy in life that he takes them all down. Now we get into the final trilogy of our show tonight, and that is 164 through 166, which starts out, you think this is going to be the Avengers versus the Lethal Legion, but oh my no, the Lethal Legion are just pawns being used. Who is our real villain, David?
Count Nefaria.
Count Nefaria. And this trilogy exists, I think, for one reason, and that is that Jim Shooter wanted the Avengers to fight Superman. And Shooter said, how can I give Nefaria Superman's powers and big cape? And so he has super strength, he can almost fly or leap tall buildings, and he has heat vision. So he gets the Wizard's speed and flying, he gets Power Man's strength, the original, the old, you know, the Atlas Power Man, Eric Johnston, and he gets Living Lasers, lasers for his eyes. So this was my first issue after I subscribed. I read 162 and I immediately subscribed, bought 163 off the rack and thought, well, kind of sucked, but Iron Man was cool, so I'll keep going. This one came in the mail in a little brown wrapper. Did you get them in the little brown wrappers?
Yes, yes. Oh, that's awesome. How I got my 225 with Black Knight on the cover.
The brown wrapper made them even better.
Oh, yeah.
Right to your house.
Yeah. You can't beat that. You can't beat that feeling when you're like 12 years old. You're like, yeah.
So To Fall by Treachery is the name of this issue. And we got John Byrne doing the art for this trilogy.
Yeah, in fact.
And it worked.
Yeah, I think this, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is John Byrne's very first work for the Avengers. This is our first time seeing John Byrne on this series.
Well, during this time, Perez was also drawing a lot of Fantastic Four issues, and so I could see where he would get kind of behind because he's trying to do two team books roughly at the same time.
And Logan's Run was sometime around here, too. So
probably,
he was he was staying busy, so So, you know, you want to call this the George Perez run, the first George Perez run, but, you know, he missed a lot of issues.
Sure.
But I mean, you know, John Byrne of 1977 is you know, nothing wrong with that.
No. I mean, we've gone Sal Buscema, George Perez, Tuska, and then John Byrne. I'm not complaining. I'm very happy with that whole run.
And keep in mind, the cover to 158 was by Jack Kirby. So.
And Jack Kirby. That's right. Yeah, that was a Kirby cover. It looked like it. Mm-hmm. So we start out, and to fall by treachery, you realize later that who falls by treachery is actually the villains of the issue. We find Tony Stark and Henry Pym, who is completely recovered now. All it took was Iron Man whipping the champion's butts to make Pym feel more like himself. I like it. But one interesting thing I want to point out here, because this is another character thing. The Beast now, like you said, is starting to kind of wonder about himself. We're going to start playing around with the Beast mind a little bit. Tony Stark's brought in a kind of some sort of a scientist lady to help him. And the Beast is like, I could have done anything she did, but they never even stopped to think to ask me if I could help, and they never listened to me because the Beast is in this whole mode now. If they just look at me and see a big furry monster and they don't see, you know, Hank McCoy,
right,
that's the scientist.
Right.
So he's starting to get down on himself. But I believe this is the story where he goes out on the street in the traditional Ben Grimm line of clothing. Doesn't Ben Grimm have like a JCPenney line with big
with
hat,
the trench coat?
Yeah. Size extra, 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 extra husky, you know?
Yeah, like he'll pass for normal like that anyway.
Yeah, yeah. If you're in the Marvel New York and you're walking along and you see somebody in a giant trench coat and a hat, it's probably some superhero that's feeling sorry for himself.
You gotta look at the feet. It's either big orange rocks or it's blue fur.
Fur, yeah. So he goes out, and this is when he discovers that women, what is it? He's LL Cool B. Ladies love Cool Beast. And so this is going to.
Which, you know, I guess, again, you know, this is the Beast I know. The fun loving, you know, crazy guy. But I guess it's all like Jim Shooter informed, like gave him that character. I don't know if he was like that before these books or not. I don't know, but definitely. And you know, the friendship he strikes up with Wonder Man, you know, going forward it's definitely a lot of fun. He's a fun character, and I know Avenger fans everywhere just, you know, wish he had stayed with the Avengers. You know, X-Men, leave him alone.
I don't think he was ever as fun in the X-Men as he is in the Avengers because he just had such a different personality from everybody else on the team that was so serious, especially when Hawkeye's not around. You don't have anybody. Everybody is so serious, you know, and then the Beast would come in and be cracking jokes and making pop culture references and everything, and it was great.
I want to point out, before we get into this issue, that Count Nefaria was one of the Avengers' very first enemies.
Hmm.
He first appeared, or at least I think it was his first appearance. It was certainly his, it was his first appearance, was in Avengers number 13 by Stan Lee in February of 1965. It is Count Nefaria, who's like the leader of, Marvel has this like stand-in for the Mafia, the Magia, or the
Magia. Magia, yeah, whatever.
He was like the leader of those guys. And and the Avengers took him on in issue 13. And it ended with the Wasp apparently dead or dying.
Hmm.
So that was and it's, I mean, I don't know if he was ever used by anybody else between that 1965 issue and this one 12 years later. But it was pretty cool that here we are with Count Nefaria, and the Avengers do have a history with him. It's easy to forget that because he was treated very differently by Stan Lee. He had different power set, different costume, and all that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
But still the same guy. So,
yeah, and his daughter was also a very important supporting character during that Bill Mantlo run of Iron Man that I was just talking about that was going on about the same time as this. I got to mention this now because if you don't know, hopefully we're having a whole bunch of new listeners that are Avengers fans but haven't been following our other shows, and then we get both groups. So some of you don't know, I'm on record for years. Iron Man is my favorite character. And if you go back to the Iron Man issues that were coming out about the same time as these Avengers issues we're talking about, Bill Mantlo was writing him. And in those issues, Iron Man's love interest for quite a while was Count Nefaria's daughter, Whitney Frost, a.k.a. Madam Mask.
Mm.
And so Iron Man was all wrapped up already in Nefaria's family through Whitney Frost at the same time this was going on, and it's going to come back again together a bit later on in the Michelinie-Layton issues of Iron Man when we get more Nefaria. I'll reference that at the very end as kind of an epilogue. So, okay. All right. So Nefaria goes and recruits the Eric Johnston Power Man. More Wizard, but nobody cared, honestly. So we were ready to get rid of the Wizard. He recruits the Whirlwind. Oh, love the Whirlwind. And the Living Laser. So these are three really cool villains I'd have liked to have seen more of.
Yeah, soldier-level villains that, yeah.
But they're powerful. I mean, they're not like the Wrecking Crew. They're actually interesting. They're not just a bunch of big, strong thugs. They have interesting powers and can do stuff. So they're robbing a bank to get money to do this, that, and the other to help Nefaria with his plan. And they get away, and Nefaria goes to Professor Sturdy, who turns out not to be sturdy enough. And he's basically paying or forcing Professor Sturdy. They ostensibly to boost the powers of these three villains so they can be a super powerful army for him. But actually, what does Nefaria wanting the Professor Sturdy to do?
Give him the powers.
Yeah. At their expense. Now, we do see Living Laser again in Iron Man a couple of years later, so he didn't die. And we know Eric Johnston, of course, goes on to be a founding Thunderbolt. But I'm not sure whatever became of the Whirlwind.
Yeah, he just remained a minor villain.
He's like the Wasp's main archenemy.
Yeah, he's like he considers Hank and Jan to be his archenemies, but Hank and Jan don't really think of him the same way, you know.
No. Yeah.
So, yeah, he's just kind of one of those goofy Silver Age characters that sticks around when you need to plug somebody in, I guess.
Yeah, he's cool. I like him. But I'm on record as loving all the cool, wacky, I mean, all the wacky, goofy villains, so I guess that's fine. So Nefaria, Power Man throws a car through the front of Avengers Mansion. This is just one more thing that's going to lead to Henry Peter Gyrick showing up later. Dang it.
I was going to wait until we discuss 167, but since that's in a different episode, let me say this. You see that scene where he throws the car through the Avengers Mansion wall or whatever. And earlier, at the splash page of 162, you saw Thor arriving at Avengers Mansion while the ambulance is being loaded up.
Yeah.
In both these scenes, you're seeing portions of the exterior of the mansion.
Mm-hmm.
But you might not realize this, but we still, here we are 164 issues in, we still have not seen a clear establishing shot of the outside of Avengers Mansion. We don't know what it looks like.
Yeah.
The, the very first time we get a clear, definitive look at the mansion is comes in 167. It took 167 issues and George Perez to come up with the look of the mansion. It's odd to me that we never got a good establishing shot, but it seems like this, where you just kind of see a portion of a wall, and the rest is implied. It's never been depicted before. I just found that interesting. A little bit.
Yeah, I guess it's originally was supposed to be based on like the Vanderbilts and the Rockefellers' houses, you know, in Midtown New York. But
it's based on see, you're going to make me have to look that up because now I can't remember the name of it.
Well, I was going to say they were always shaped more like vertically oriented, like big townhouses, whereas this looks more like an actual standalone building that takes up a big lot, you know, which is not how those rich people's townhouses were.
Yeah, so if you were to go to Wikipedia and look up the Frick House, actually, if you search Avengers Mansion, you'll find a link for it. But that was, I think, the inspiration. You've got that style of architecture right in the middle of New York City, and it's behind a fence and everything. So it was definitely, I guess it was Perez, maybe it was somebody else, took inspiration from the Frick House. So that's worth looking up.
Cool. So they fight, and the Lethal Legion trio seem more powerful, which is disturbing, but then their powers all suddenly give out. And the Avengers whip their tails pretty easily, and they think, well, that was what's going on with that. And then Super Nefaria shows up, ready to kick butt, which rolls us out of 164 into 165. It's really just one big, long story broken over three issues. So 165.
So that final shot of 164, like you say, the Superman version of Nefaria.
Oh, yeah.
That was the moment, I guess you could say. That was the debut of the redefinition, the new look, which I think has defined him ever since. Like when he shows up earlier in this issue, he still looks like he did back when Stan Lee wrote him as some kind of 19th century
aristocrat or something. Yeah.
But here he is in a Superman, you know, the equivalent of the Superman costume in the flaring cape.
Totally.
And as far as I know, I'm not a Nefaria expert, but that's pretty much been his look ever since.
Well,
am I wrong there?
No, but I don't know if he's ever shown up again after he was killed in Iron Man 116. I guess.
Oh, now Kurt and George did a.
Oh, that's right. They did a whole
crossed over with Thunderbolts and all that. That was an excellent.
Yeah,
story.
That's right. I forgot that they brought him back for sure in that same look. Yeah, but there's a great story that would have put him to rest that Michelinie wrote, and we'll get to that at the, like I said, the epilogue. So anyway, to kind of blow through 165, it's really just a battle issue where you get to see, like I said, you get to see. The Avengers fighting Superman, and it goes about like you would expect. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, you know, we can kind of zip through
it. But you got to talk about the very end.
Yeah, I mean, they fight. Everybody takes a shot at him. They all get trashed. Henry Peter Gyrick walks into the ruins of the mansion and is looking around. We're going to see more of him coming up later. Everybody takes a shot at him. Even the Wizard takes a shot at him. I'm zipping along here.
Yeah, go to the end.
my iPad is slow. Sorry, I have all these in a box over there, but I didn't want to dig them out. I just have it on the iPad. Just page after page of really awesome battle by John Byrne. Yeah, you can't go wrong there. But ultimately, I believe Nefaria drops a building on them to trap them all.
You got to get to the last page there.
Well. At one point, he does that, right?
You might be thinking of Graviton.
No. He drops a building on him, and then somebody shows up. I may have skipped right by it and digs him out.
Oh, yep.
Now I'm going the wrong direction. Hold on. So yeah, that's the cover is the building falling on him.
Right. Okay.
So that somebody they get out and I guess Thor peels the thing back and gets him out, right, or something. I don't know. Yep. But anyway, they get out. One of them's been holding up the roof, and one of them's been doing this and that and the other. So Nefaria wants Thor to show up to test his strength against Thor. And at the end, of course, Thor shows up, and we get next issue, Day of the God Slayer.
Yeah, so that was the big cliffhanger. All of a sudden, Thor has not been in the issue up until now, and then boom, with a bolt of lightning, here's Thor on the scene, and the hammer's coming right at Nefaria's face, and that's how the issue ends. And it's pretty awesome. That's talk about a cliffhanger. That's the way to end an issue right there.
And it echoes the Graviton story where the big bad is beating everybody else pretty easily, and now he wants Thor, and Thor shows up at the last second to give us a big dramatic close.
Yeah, and I know what the payoff is later, which won't be in this episode, but you know, at the time, as you're reading these, it seems awfully convenient, you know, like a writer's crutch. Like, oh, okay, you're just going to have the bad guy beat up the Avengers and then Thor shows up at the end. You know, you've already done this once, now you're doing it again. It's like, you know, that could be pointed to as a criticism. But what we find out later, of course, is that was all set up. Shooter knew what he was doing.
Well, it was a writer's crutch. He just had a good excuse. He just had a good reason.
He had a story reason, right? Yeah.
So Thor and Nefaria fight for a little bit, and Nefaria surprises Thor with how potent he is. Meanwhile, Pym goes back to the lab where the Vision is still not recovered from fighting Ultron, and he basically goes ahead and wakes Vision up. Vision says he's fine. I'm fully functional, ready to go fight. So now Thor and the Vision together are fighting Nefaria, which is awesome.
Oh, yeah.
You got to love a Vision. You got to love a villain powerful enough that Thor and the Vision both can be hammering away at him and not be losing.
Yeah, exactly.
and again, we see Henry Peter Gyrick. We don't know who he is yet. Still sneaking around, taking pictures and seeing what's going on. More fights. Professor Sturdy shows up gave Nefaria's powers. And he says Nefaria's aging really rapidly and is going to die soon and only he can save him. Now bookmark that, because this story changes about a half dozen times over the rest of this issue and then Iron Man.
Okay.
So he says that. Nefaria goes crazy, goes berserk, starts running around. He's going to destroy the whole city if he's got to die. And finally, between the Vision, Thor, Wonder Man, having Captain America's shield, all the heavy hitters take a shot at Nefaria. Scarlet Witch zaps him. Thor knocks him down. He's stumbling around. And then the Vision delivers the coup de grace. What does the Vision do? You remember?
He goes up. He's like a mile in the sky. And he just I guess becomes his heaviest weight.
Yeah.
And from a mile up, just like lands like just flat on him. Boom.
and you think the Vision might be taking himself out too. But he comes out of the... He survives it pretty well. Nefaria, though, gets knocked out. All of that, and Nefaria is knocked out, which is kind of astonishing. So,
yeah.
so then we get another version of the story there, which is that where Yellowjacket says that Professor Sturdy was lying about Nefaria's impending death, hoping to con Nefaria into giving himself up to be, quote, cured, unquote. The rapid aging was just a temporary side effect. Actually, the super energy in his cells would have extended his lifespan indefinitely. He was, in effect, immortal. But now Sturdy's given him, quote, the cure, unquote, to take the power and presumably the immortality away from Nefaria. So before we get to this last bit at the very end that's going to lead us into the Scarlet Witch and Wanda and Pietro, what happens later in Iron Man 116 is that Whitney Frost returns. Iron Man broke up with her, you know, way back a couple of years earlier. And in 116, which is about a year and a half later after all this, she comes back because now Nefaria is still alive. But he's in like in the cryogenic tube or something, preserving him. Apparently, Michelinie read the part where Nefaria was dying of old age, but not the part where it was a scam and he really was okay. So Whitney Frost wants Iron Man to cure him, and she attacks Iron Man with a big Jupiter landing vehicle, like the Death Probe on $6 Million Man, but bigger. And during the battle, Iron Man shoves the big probe, the big Jupiter probe, out of the way. And at the end, you find out that he crushed Nefaria's cryogenic tube when he did it. So Whitney vows revenge on Iron Man, and she knows he's Tony Stark, for accidentally crushing her father. So I can't remember.
That was Michelinie?
Yeah, yeah. That was one of the first issues of Michelinie issues when he took over from Mantlo. And so I can't remember. I'm sure Kurt went back and reconciled all this, because if there's one thing Kurt Busiek can do besides write a good story, it's reconcile differing accounts from previous issues, isn't it?
Yeah, no doubt. He kind of casually fixed things left and right.
Yeah.
But not making it the focus of his stories. So, right. Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah. So, anyway, the Nefarious story is far from over, and it becomes very convoluted in the days to come.
Okay.
But for now, he's beaten. And then the last thing we see is a little old man, looks like Santa Claus, getting off a boat, or getting on a boat in Vladivostok, which is in Russia. And he looks at a locket that has two pictures in it that looks remarkably like the Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver.
Yep.
And then he gets on the ship for America.
Isn't that awesome? I mean, there you are. There's a writer, at the top of his craft. And what I love about these, and I feel like this has been lost to some degree with modern comics, is this story wraps up, but he's planting a seed for the next story. But, as we know, this isn't really the next story. This payoff comes after the Korvac saga.
Golly.
So he's really weaving a big, he's playing the long game.
He really is. And he's mapped out to some degree like 2 years worth of stories.
Exactly.
So, it's pretty amazing. And last thing I'll say about this then is, this is why I was never one of the reasons I was never a huge fan of the second shooter run. And at some point we can talk about it, but
definitely have me on for that one, because I can.
Sure, because the thing is, not only did I not like what he did with some of the characters in it, particularly Pym, but in the second run, I never got the sense that he mapped out all this intricate tapestry of stories and characters to any degree of the way he did. In these issues, like you say, I mean, he wrote these issues like it was a giant, like it was Game of Thrones or something, this incredibly complex novel with plots and subplots and things being laid down 2 years in advance. And I guess it's just a lot to ask any writer to do that over again,
Yeah, and keep in mind that with the second run, he was also serving as editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
So, he maybe couldn't afford to invest the same amount of time in it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because those were my first issues, I remain very fond of them. But certainly, this era, and like I said at the beginning, starting with around 150 or whatever, it was really kind of a bad little stretch there for the Avengers series. The good stuff doesn't really get started till right here with 158. But from 158 all the way up through, let's just say 199.
Yeah.
Or maybe 200, although that's very, obviously, it's very controversial.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of negative backlash there. But still,
we'll get
that
there.
That portion of Avengers from 158 up around to around 200, I mean, this is absolutely the good stuff right here.
Cream of the crop.
Yeah. I mean, in what we talked about tonight, this series of consecutive stories, with the writer at the top of his craft and some of the best artists ever in the business working on these stories. You got top-notch writing, top-notch art. Man, if you've never read these issues, oh my goodness, you gotta check them out.
So good. It's great, great battle sequences and everything, but these creative people understood that all the great combat is just in service to a good story and good characters.
Right.
It should never be the point. It's just part of the process, and they got that, and they delivered in spades. So
it's not just like banging action figures together.
There's
real story and character drama there.
Yeah, yeah. I've always said if there's one thing more than anything else that influenced how I write the Sentinels, it is without a doubt how Jim Shooter wrote. I mean, Starlin to a certain degree, of course, and Michelinie to a certain degree, and then Claremont to a certain degree, and later Dan Abnett. But I mean, at the core of it is these issues. Jim Shooter and Perez and Byrne and the other guys in these issues, they absolutely lay the foundation. I can't think of a better place that we could have started the podcast series for the Avengers than right here, at least for me, because this is where I started, and this means the most to me of anything. If I could only have one Avengers thing in the world, it wouldn't be the movies, it wouldn't be anything else, it would be this run of comics that we're looking at right now. So
it's hard to argue with that. I mean, these weren't my first issues. These weren't my first experience with the series. But just, you know, I do have a good perspective on the entire thing from Stan Lee up to, oh my goodness, Brian Michael Bendis. So, you know, and
he
who
shall not be named on this program. Yeah. Edit that out.
All right. Yeah. You can cut his name out. Sorry about that. We'll try to keep his name to a minimum. But certainly looking at the entire series, these issues absolutely stand out. And, I mean, they're just, like I said, writing, art, coming together, and it's the all-time best. Not just classic Avengers comics, but classic Marvel comics.
Yeah, absolutely. Classic stories. Yeah. All right. Well, we've gone on quite a while, so I guess it's time to wrap things up. I could have almost broke this into two episodes, but I think I'm just going to leave it intact as our debut, and since it covers one kind of concise block of issues. So, David, I appreciate you coming on.
Hey, man, thanks for having me. It was awesome.
And we'll pick back up again in the future with 167 through 177 and talk about the Korvac and Ultron saga, which should be fantastic. It's just as good in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah.
You guys out there, be sure to check out the White Rocket podcast. Like I said, it's another one of the Earth Station One shows that I host, that David's on there some, John Ringer's on there some, Jim Yelton. We have quite a few guests come on and talk about all kind of pop culture things. And otherwise, Avengers Assemble will return in a couple of weeks, probably, or a week or two, with another important topic. We've got George Gaston coming on. He's got quite a few interesting topics. And we're going to have several others. So,
I look forward to the potential of this show. It should be awesome.
It should be. If I don't screw this up, it should be great. Oh, no pressure, Van. All right, David. Well, thanks a bunch. I don't really have a sign off yet. I haven't come up with anything like on the Wishbone show. I say our time is up. We thank you for yours. And on the White Rocket show, I say the White Rocket's going to get on out of here for another week. On this show, I guess I'll just say, David, Avengers Assemble.
Avengers Assemble.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.